Hello and welcome to This Climate Business, the podcast about turning the climate crisis into opportunity. Please follow us on social media and rate the podcast as it helps others to find us. I hope you enjoy the show.
Hello, I'm Ross Ingalls. Climate change activism is everywhere, in politics, in business, on the streets, and increasingly now in the courts. A good recent example is the decision of the Supreme Court in February to let activist Mike Smith proceed with his action against seven of New Zealand's biggest polluters. What's driving the movement towards climate change litigation, and just where might it take us? Nick Chapman has some ideas. He's a senior associate with Simpson Grierson in Wellington, and he's with us on This Climate Business today. Nick, welcome. Could we start perhaps by pointing out where climate change litigation has been fought out currently?
Well, thanks so much for having me. Yeah, look, I think the example that you've raised, the Supreme Court's decision in Smith, is probably the really big example that everyone's talking about at the moment. And it's a really interesting claim with Mike Smith. So he's the climate change spokesman for the Iwi Chairs Forum, and he's brought this claim against seven really large companies in respect of their greenhouse gas emissions, and he's brought claims for negligence and for nuisance, and he's also this new claim of breach of a duty not to cause climate harm. And we sort of got to the point where the organisations that he was bringing the claim against sought to what we call strike out the claim, so sort of say, well, look, there's just no valid cause of action here, and so Mr. Smith shouldn't be allowed to proceed. Mm-hmm. And that's worked its way through the courts, and now the Supreme Court has said, well, yes, he can proceed. And so it effectively gets Mr. Smith to the start line and allows him to bring his claim afresh. And while that's definitely the example that everyone's talking about at the moment, it's really only one example, both in New Zealand and overseas. So in answer to your question of where has climate change litigation been fought, the answer is really here, there and everywhere.
Mm. So you wrote an opinion piece recently for the Simpson Grierson website about climate change litigation, and you listed a number of areas of exposure for the companies that are facing this litigation. Companies and organisations, I guess. Can you just run through some of those quickly for us?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think the purpose of the article was to think about, look, now that there's this Supreme Court judgment and Smith and the dust has started to settle a little bit, where else are we seeing these types of proceedings happening? And what's really interesting, I think, is that there's a mix of some really old areas of the law which are being used in ways that you would kind of expect. So judicial review claims against central government, claims under the Fair Trading Act for greenwashing. But there's also a lot of new efforts and new steps that are being taken. And Mike Smith's example is I think one of those, of asking the courts to expand the law into areas where it hasn't been used before to address these issues.
So would it be fair to say that the tide is turning towards climate change litigation? Its time is now?
I'm not sure necessarily that the tide is changing or that we'll necessarily see a whole bunch of climate change activists being successful in the courts, and that being a real area that change has been made. I think it's more a case of that people are looking to see what's happening overseas and are realising that this is an avenue that can be utilised to apply pressure really to emitters, or to apply pressure to central government. And I think that poses a real challenge for the courts, because the courts typically in New Zealand, they tend to be restrained and principled, and so how they deal with these issues is really curious to see. And it's interesting when you think about the different judgments that we've seen in the Smith litigation. There were decisions that went both ways, and judges who had differing opinions on how these questions should be approached.
Right. And I guess the law, like everything else, changes over time as well. It responds to existential crises like climate change.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, so we have a common law system in New Zealand where the courts are faced with new and difficult questions and have been for, if you're talking about the heritage back through English law for literally hundreds of years and different issues that come up, and the law changes and adapts to what those problems are. Mm-hmm. So in some respects, this is it's a really new and exciting and difficult area. But at the same time, the courts regularly have to deal with societal changes, new technology, and needs to think differently around those questions and how people are seeking to enforce their legal rights or challenge their legal obligations.
Let's look at some of those touch points then. Director liability.
Yeah, yep. So overseas, we've seen a trend of special purpose vehicles being set up to bring claims against the directors of large companies, and really bringing claims against directors with a view to challenging their investment practices around fossil fuels. It's not the easiest road. So generally what happens is that you'll have an entity which is set up, which buys shares in a company or might buy shares in, say, a superannuation scheme or something like that, or invest in a superannuation scheme. And then we'll typically try to bring what's called a derivative claim. So it tries to step into the shoes of the company itself and to bring proceedings against the directors. And we've seen that the best example of that is in the UK. So there's an entity called Client Earth, which sought to do that against the directors of Shell. And that those proceedings went as far as the Court of Appeal there, and the Court of Appeal said, no, look, we're not gonna let the claim carry through. And in doing so, it was pretty clear that the courts are going to be generally unwilling to question the investment decisions of directors, you know, that those are difficult decisions, they're specific to the particular company involved. And so the courts don't like second guessing that. Mm. It's interesting in New Zealand as well, because I think the route is potentially even more challenging. So we've recently had changes to our Companies Act. So directors are required to act in the best interests of the company. And the recent changes mean that in approaching that, directors can think not only about maximising profits, but they're also entitled to think about environmental, social, governance issues as well, what we call ESG. But while that change has happened, it's the wording of the legislation is permissive, so directors can consider those issues,
right,
but they don't have to. And you can contrast that from the position in the UK where directors do have to consider those issues. So there's almost more leeway in New Zealand for directors, and that produces more of a barrier as a result to people trying to bring similar claims.
Right. Net, I suppose what it means is that if you're a director of a major company, you're probably keeping half an eye on this threat around the corner.
Yeah, look, and I think it's been a busy time for directors in New Zealand recently. There was another really big decision out of the Supreme Court for the directors of Mainzeal. So there is already, I think, a lot of awareness for directors, what they need to be doing, how they need to be thinking. And this is definitely a big part of that as well. Mm. So it's all, it all builds and adds to itself.
Another intriguing one that you listed in your opinion piece is mandatory climate reporting, litigation around that. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, so we've had changes recently to climate-related disclosures that are needed for particular organisations. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about really big organisations. So as an example, I think we're think about listed issuers that have a market cap of more than 60 million, or certain companies that have assets under management of more than $1 billion. So they're big players. Mm-hmm. And there's a requirement for them to disclose information regarding the effects of climate change on their businesses. And we're at quite an interesting time because we're sort of at the first round of disclosures that companies will be making. Mm. And it's going to be curious to see the level of detail that they're producing, and also the view that the FMA as the regulator takes in terms of what standard is necessary. Mm. and whether it will take any enforcement action where it feels that standard hasn't been met.
Mm. Another one then, changes and challenges to the emissions trading scheme.
Yeah, well, the emissions trading scheme is, one of New Zealand's primary ways of dealing with the effects of climate change, and we've had it for a while now. I think it's fair to say that there has been a decent amount of tinkering with it and the way in which it operates, and that I think causes some angst and some concern for participants, particularly where they're trying to make long-term decisions and trying to participate in it. And so that's been a space where there's been a certain degree of dealings between central government and then people who are dealing with the scheme. Last year, the previous government had a really wide-ranging review into the various aspects of the ETS and how it operates, and that's been shelved by the new government. But there are certainly changes which have been implemented and which are attracting a fair degree of scrutiny.
Mm. So what I take out of this is that there's a range of points of exposure for organisations, and the environment is that they operate in is changing under their feet, that they need to go into this with their eyes open, right?
Yeah, I think that's right. And it's, it's not just large, large companies that may have a history in this area, but it's risks for central government and the way in which they're approaching these issues. There's also, I think with risks there comes opportunities as well, and opportunities to be more alert to these issues and thinking about how companies approach them in a really educated way without overstepping the boundaries. So I think it's climate change litigation is part of a broader discussion around climate change as a whole and the risks that it presents and how different people, organisations, businesses, government approach those. But yeah, look, it's certainly the litigation aspect to it is very much real.
Yeah. Should we be surprised, Nick, that this is happening now, not 20 years ago?
Look, I think that as the focus on climate change as an issue increases, it's natural then that the range of steps that are taken kind of increases in scope. And so climate change litigation isn't necessarily a particular litigation isn't a particularly obvious way of engaging with climate change issues. Mm. It's costly. We don't. I think as a general rule, it's fair to say that New Zealand is not a particularly litigious country, and so there's perhaps more of an opportunity for us to be more of an opportunity for people to be looking to seeing what's happening overseas, thinking about how the law and the rules are changing, and then as a secondary consideration to that, thinking around, well, okay, how have the various rights, obligations, duties that people have, how have those changed, and where is there risk or scope of litigation as a consequence?
Mm. Well, you've just gone some way to answering what I was going to ask you which is if we were to put you in the shoes of a climate change activist,
okay,
how you would assess litigation today in New Zealand as a weapon?
Yeah, well, interesting, really interesting. I mean, I think if you were stepping back and just looking at it as a whole, then you would say there are difficulties with climate change, with, you know, seeking to use litigation as a means of bringing about change. And in particular, as I said before, litigation's costly. We have a really strong sense of parliamentary supremacy in New Zealand, which means that the, you know, particularly where central government is acting through legislation, then there are very limited avenues for challenging that. The courts don't have the ability to strike down legislation in New Zealand in the way that they do in other countries. And we have a judiciary which I think it's fair to say is reasonably restrained. You know, it's not political, and it tends to adopt a degree of deference towards situations where it feels it shouldn't stray. So whether that's decisions, you know, from government which are particularly laden in policy, or in the example I was talking about before where the courts aren't willing to second guess the investment decisions of directors, that there tends to be a presumption that the courts won't overstep that boundary. But then, you know, you also need to think about and look at, well, what's actually happening on the ground. And the decision from the Supreme Court in Smith is really interesting to see how, at least as far as the Supreme Court sees its role, and that it is willing to be perhaps a little bit stronger than what others may have thought.
Right, and that's one of the reasons it's significant, isn't it? Because my reading is that it sent a bit of a ripple through the legal world, but also through the business world, because there was a sense of, we're kind of, in New Zealand, we're, you know, in this space, we're moving into uncharted territory.
Yeah, look, I think that's right. And I think, you know, it's quite difficult to know where the rubber hits the road on that. And so, as we were saying at the start, Mr. Smith now has the opportunity to bring his claim. He's really, you know, he's got to the starting line. And what that means is that if there is very likely to be a high court hearing from this stage, which will be fully argued and which will have factual evidence and which will have expert evidence, and where the court will be required to weigh up those different issues, and it will have the guidance from the Supreme Court in the earlier decision, and seeing about, okay, well, look, you know, okay, these causes of action of negligence, nuisance, they can be used in this way, but in really practical terms, how easy is it to make out a claim? How easy is it to show loss has occurred, and how willing will the courts be to grant some form of relief, whether that's monetary relief or just declaratory relief?
Well, none of this seems easy. I mean, you made the point before that litigation is expensive. Now, the other thing that's obvious from the Smith case is it's also really, really slow, because he started this process in 2019.
Yep.
And he's only now got to the point where he can take an action.
Yep.
I suppose whether or not that's a failure of justice is a subject for a different conversation. But it does kind of mean that if you're a climate change activist, that you need to take into account this asymmetry. They are very unlikely to have the same amount of money and perhaps not as much time as these large corporations that they're going toe to toe with.
Yeah, look, I think that's right. I mean, the issues of a sort of David and Goliath dynamic are certainly there, but our courts are experienced with dealing with those types of issues before, and there's good reason to have faith in the quality of our justice system. We definitely need to be alert to access to justice and issues like that, but the judiciary in New Zealand is a very good judiciary. I mean, I think in terms of the time that it takes to bring proceedings, yeah, look, that's right. You know, litigation is slow, particularly where you've got the ability to appeal when it takes time to resolve these issues. And that's sort of part and parcel of litigation. You know, there are definitely times where the courts can move very, very quickly if they need to, you know, if they need to stop something that is about to happen. But as a general rule, those are, you know, those are really specific and obvious examples of immediate harm. You know, something's about to be published or some assets are about to disappear overseas, something like that, which requires the court to turn on a dime, and it can. But whether it's willing to do so with issues like climate change, I think, you know, speaking frankly, seems unlikely. It's not to say that issues associated with climate change aren't urgent. It's just that it's not urgent in the way that the courts would typically approach questions of urgency.
Mm. Last question then, Nick. If you, like me, have a lay interest in this topic, but you're not a lawyer, where do you go to kind of figure all this out? Litigation has a language of its own, for example. Where's a user-friendly starting point?
Yeah, good question. And it sort of goes to what I was saying before around that point around access to justice. You know, it's important that when the courts are taking steps that people understand what those steps are and why they've been taken, and that you shouldn't necessarily need a law degree to understand that. We're helped in climate change litigation by the fact that these are big social issues, and so normally the language that goes along with it is more accessible, and the issues that go along with it are more accessible. And you know, when you read the Supreme Court judgment, the court has a job to do in applying and interpreting laws, and those are difficult questions, and they inherently involve difficult legal analysis. But they are accessible and readable, perhaps quite long. An answer to your question, I think it's really good to see that there is a public interest in what is happening in the courts in this space, and that there are good newspaper articles, there are good podcasts which are addressing these issues. The various law firms, you know, whenever there are big decisions, they publish articles around what these decisions mean, which are intended to be accessible and digestible, and to look at, you know, the practical implications, what this means moving forward. So there is definitely information out there, and I think that that's probably going to increase over time.
Hmm. Nick Chapman from Simpson Grierson, thanks for joining us on This Climate Business.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to This Climate Business. If you like the show, please rate us, as it helps others to find us. Ka kite anō. Thank you.